Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning. Welcome. This is Spirit Mornings. I'm Bruce McGregor. She is
Chris McGregor.
And today, honey, we're joined again by Mike Aquilina, author of Mass of the Early Christians and several other books on the early church, all published through our Sunday Visitor. And of course, we have to mention the Grail Code as well. Mike, the Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, we encourage you to check out that website, www.salvationhistory.com. And Mike, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be back. Happy New Year.
And to you too.
Bruce, pinch me. I'm so excited. I'm not dreaming. We are talking to Mike again, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Oh. It's a new year. It's a new Mike.
I hope so. Those resolutions.
For a Eucharistic people, we have to believe in the power of transformation, and at least that's my hope anyway.
Absolutely. And I guess we have a lot of days to ponder transformation, these feasts coming up.
I just want to thank you on behalf of not only Bruce and myself, but for our entire listening community who have told us over and over and over again how much they love hearing you on the radio, having you break open the lives of the fathers, and just your presence on the air. It's such a tremendous blessing, Mike. Thank you.
Well, the fathers are a blessing, have been a blessing to me, and I'm so glad to be able to share it. And it's so good to see so many people getting excited about the history of the early church. It's an important connection for us when we see the monuments that have been standing for so long, and we see that the people who were living in New Testament times and the years, every generation afterward, were practicing the same faith we practice in our parishes today. It strengthens us to know that our faith is the ancient faith.
Since I'm in the mood of giving out thanks, I just want to thank you also for the new expanded edition of the Fathers of the Church, an introduction to the first Christian teachers, because you've not only refined some of the wonderful gems that you brought us in your first edition of the Fathers of the Church, but you've also given us more fathers and now some mothers to think about.
Well, sure. And you know what? The reason I did that is because it was the question that came up most often when the first edition came out. People, well, I suppose the title is provocative. It's the Fathers of the Church. So mm-hmm. A lot of people ask me, were there mothers of the church? It was one of the standard questions I got whenever I did radio or TV interviews. Mm-hmm. And so that took some explanation. You know, we had to get the word out there that indeed there were mothers of the church, and as a matter of fact, the woman whose feast day is celebrated today was referred to as Mother Ama Synclitica in her own day. But the problem is that the fathers of the church were the teachers of mm-hmm. the church, and that it was rare in late antiquity for women to receive the kind of education they would require to be teachers in the church. Women just didn't do the writing as men did, and the teaching. So there were rarer opportunities to have that position. On the other hand, they had more opportunities within the church than outside the church. We know of many more Christian women writers from late antiquity than pagan women writers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important to point out that, as you cited from Professor Rodney Stark in his book, The Rise of Christianity, that women made up a disproportionate number of converts at the time in the early church.
That's right, because Christianity meant an advance for them in the quality of their lives. All of a sudden, they weren't faced with the kind of abuses that they were faced with in the pagan world. Things like abortion and contraception and the methods that were practiced then were killing women, mm-hmm. as they are today. That there are methods of abortion and contraception that are really detrimental to the health of women mm-hmm. and the lives of women, certainly the mental health, and we see that all around us. It was true in the ancient world. People did not want to live that way, and because Christians held up this life of chastity and purity, women would not be exploited in the Christian church the way they were exploited in the pagan world. So it was very attractive. And Rodney Stark, of course, points that out in his book, The Rise of Christianity, in a very persuasive way, that women held a certain kind of leadership in the church, even though they did not hold holy orders. And they were probably responsible for many of the conversions that happened in late antiquity.
Right, and they made up quite a group of the very early martyrs in the church as well.
That's true. That's something that we see coming up again and again. Saint Blandina in France was one of the most famous of the martyrs, because we have eyewitness accounts of her martyrdom. We also have the transcript from her interrogation, and also because her martyrdom took several days. They tortured her over the course of several days, and her witness was really one of the things that gave courage to the martyrs in the following centuries after her. She was in the second century in France, and then of course in Africa we have Saints Perpetua and Felicity, whom we remember in the first Eucharistic prayer, and we have the account of their trials from the hand of Perpetua herself. She kept a sort of journal while she was in prison, and it was preserved by Tertullian and by others. These were the great heroes from among the martyrs and great witnesses to the faith. I include them in the new edition of the Fathers of the Church just so people know the great position that women had in the early church.
Right. And they were very strong mothers of great saints and of those fathers. Of course, one that stands out right away is Saint Monica. And she may not necessarily be a mother of the church, but there are such strong examples of females who have such strong faith. I recall in our conversations of St. Basil and others that you've talked about, their families were such a great influence for them.
And it was a maternal influence in many of these cases. It's interesting in the case of St. Perpetua, for example, in the second century, that motherhood, her own motherhood, the fact that she was mothering her infant child, she gave birth while she was in prison, and she nursed her child while she was in prison. And this is a dominant motif in her story, and we can see her motherliness mm-hmm. Expressed also in her encouragement for her fellow prisoners. This is something that comes through again and again. You mentioned Saint Monica, and I have a great devotion to her. I know a lot of people do, especially a lot of parents, because she was somebody who prayed for her son and also prayed for her husband so that they would be converted. And she kept this up over decades until both son and husband came into the fold. So Monica is a great example. We'll, of course, be visiting, you and I, Chris, we'll be visiting her remains, her relics, in Rome at the Church of St. Augustine near Piazza Navona, and that's not too far off. But I digressed.
No, that's never a digression when you talk about those things.
Yeah.
It's very compelling. I have to bring up a modern saint when you talk about these mothers of the church, especially the saint that we're talking about today, because I'm reminded of the teachings of St. Edith Stein, Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, where she talks about, for women, it's that nurturing. It may not, many of these women in the early church, they couldn't write, and they weren't taught those. They didn't necessarily write the letters or the sermons, but it's just in their nurturing of the faith and nurturing of those early Christians that kept the faith alive.
That's true, and Rodney Stark points that out, too, that the women were able to gather a family together and hold a family together in a way that men just don't or can't in most cases. The saint whom we're remembering today, Saint Syncletica, her very name means gathering together. So it was probably a providential naming of her, or maybe she developed the virtues because of her name, because she was someone who pondered the virtues at great depth.
Well, why don't you tell us about her?
Well, it's interesting to talk about her. She was one of the desert mothers. We often hear about the desert fathers, the men like Saint Anthony of Egypt who went out into the deserts of Egypt to live the ascetical life, extremely rigorous life, living off whatever they could scrounge together in their caves or huts. And there are still people who do this today. Well, we often hear about the desert fathers. We don't as often hear about the desert mothers. But there was a whole movement of women who moved out to the deserts to live that way, to live the same life. And she came from a wealthy family, Saint Syncletica, and she was one of four children, I believe. She had two brothers who died young, and she had a sister who was blind. And when her parents died and she received the inheritance, she made the decision just to sell it off and to go into the desert to live with her sister. And they kind of set up a life of hermits out in the desert. And because of the way she lived her life and because of the way she talked about virtue, many people would go out to the desert to seek her counsel. And you know, they say that cities grew up in the desert. Well, this is how it happened, mm-hmm. because these teachers out in the desert would become renowned for their counsel, their spiritual direction, and many people would go out and seek it from them. And many of the people who went out to St. Synclitica were women. And it's interesting, we don't know a lot about her. We don't even know a lot about her ascetical practices, because she really emphasized the importance of not drawing attention to yourself, of doing and disappearing.
Right.
And she said, just as a treasure that is exposed loses its value, so a virtue which is known vanishes.
Mm.
Just as wax melts when it is near fire, so the soul is destroyed by praise and loses all the results of its labor. Well, she lived that so well that we don't know a lot about her life. All we have are her sayings, the things that she said that people wrote down and then preserved in their traditions. And the one thing she always focused on was growth in virtue. She emphasized that we have to develop these habits in the moral life, in the spiritual life. And she was very practical, and she was very homey. To continue what you were saying before, she was very maternal, and she often included in her teachings examples from family life, from housekeeping, from cooking, from cleaning, and that sort of thing, the things that would have been immediate to a mother in her time, the tasks of everyday life. So these are things that came up again and again for her. These were very feminine, very maternal touches that she brought out. She always emphasized humility. She always emphasized struggle and the importance of being in it for the long haul, staying put and keeping to what you're doing.
Right.
One interesting thing about her is her profound appreciation for the vocation of people in the world. It's usually translated in the sayings of the fathers. The word is usually translated as seculars, but sometimes in the writings of the desert fathers, because they were exhorting each other not to give in to the temptation to go back to the city, to go back to the world,
mm-hmm.
sometimes their rhetoric would be extreme. But in her case, we find an appreciation for the vocation of men and women who are living in the world, and she recognizes that they have a different vocation, but it's a real vocation, and they're needed where they are, and that they face temptations and trials, and just as the monks do, just as the hermits do, and they have to grow in virtue just the way the monks and hermits do, although there will be different virtues and different temptations that we're going to face.
She sounded like Vatican II.
she does, doesn't she?
How about that?
And this is a long time ago in the desert. We're not entirely sure of the dates of her life. The earliest biography is often attributed to Saint Athanasius, although many people don't think it was written by him. But it was the scholars who study it think it was written about a century later. So we're looking at the 4th or 5th century.
This is why it's so important to study and to really pray with the lives of the fathers and the mothers, because it shows us that our teachings, as you have always told us, Mike, is something that's rooted back to the earliest foundations of the church. So when something is expressed, those thoughts in Vatican II, you can find them, that they've been taught throughout the whole time in the church.
That's right, and especially with so many of the ascetical doctrines, it's interesting, all of the things that we find in her, even though we only know a few of her sayings, probably about fewer than 30 of her sayings we have, but a lot of them witness to different doctrines and that sort of thing. One that I find interesting is her witness to the doctrine of purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
She said, in the world, if we commit an offense, even an involuntary one, we are thrown into prison. Let us likewise cast ourselves into prison because of our sins, so that voluntary remembrance may anticipate the punishment that is to come. So she's saying that if we take on suffering as penance in this life, it will it will be much easier for us than if we just put it off until purgatory, when we can't really advance on our own. She witnesses to many, many things like this, just in those 30 sayings that we have.
Wow.
I like, I mentioned before that she has a lot of domestic examples, and one of her most famous ones is about lighting a fire in the house, you know, keeping a fire going, which was so crucial to domestic life because it provided warmth and light and cooking space and everything. But she said, "In the beginning, there are a great many battles and a good deal of suffering for those who are advancing toward God, and afterwards, ineffable joy. It is like those who wish to light a fire. At first, they are choked by the smoke and cry, and by this means obtain what they seek. As it is said, our God is a consuming fire. So we must kindle the divine fire in ourselves through tears and hard work."
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, it's everyday life. And these are the homey examples that she invoked to teach a spiritual life, and you can see why so many women, especially, beat a path out to the desert to hear her teaching.
Well, it's just everyone was seeking holiness, and it to give up a sinful ways. You do suffer because you do fall in love with those things.
Oh, sure. They have a pull because they play on the good things of the world that God has made for us, but they just promise them in a disordered way, and so they're taking the good things of God and making us addicted to them in a way that God did not intend.
Well, what a fascinating woman. Even though we know so little of her, she seems to have left her quite an indelible mark on the lives of the church.
Oh, yes, yes. There's so much, too, that she says that's useful today and very practical. One of my favorite quotations from her is that obedience is preferable to asceticism. So she's saying that it's better for us to obey than to take on severe penances and fasting and long prayers and that sort of thing. Obedience is preferable to asceticism. The one teaches pride, the other humility.
Mm.
Because in obedience, you know, we're submitting. But when we take on a kind of extreme rigors in the ascetical life, we can become proud of that. It's good that we do that, but there's a danger of pride there. Whereas when we obey, there's not much of a danger of pride because we're submitting to the will of another who serves in the place of God.
Okay. Yes. I think even today as Catholics, so many of us have that when we talk about obedience, somehow as Americans, that is such a, well, I can't be obedient. I mean, I'm an individual. I'm free. But even in obeying to the teaching authority of the church. And
absolutely.
And just taking it in and learning it and taking it to prayer and trusting in it. We don't want to do that.
She also has one of the early examples of the great advice to love the sinner and hate the sin. She says it in her own characteristic way. She said, "It is good not to get angry, but if this should happen, the apostle says, the apostle does not allow you a whole day for this passion, for he says, let not the sun go down on your anger."
Mm.
In Ephesians, St. Paul says it. "Will you wait till all your time is ended? Why hate the man who has grieved you? It is not he who has done the wrong, but the devil. Hate sickness, but not the sick person."
Oh.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I like that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Wow.
I'm so glad we're archiving these so I can listen to Mike say that over and over again. That's perfect.
Listen to St. Synclitica over and over again.
Absolutely.
There we go. Well, Mike, we're going to take a very quick break, and then we'll be back to continue. This is Spirit Mornings. We're with Mike Aquilina, Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Spirit Mornings here at KVSS with Bruce and Chris. Don't go away.